the Act, and that's a project that has been working in Rwanda since 2004. I also am an internist who works with women in HIV for a long time in Chicago, both in care and research, and currently I'm a physician at Boston Healthcare for the Homeless. So my presentation is Domestic Violence, Successful Interventions in an HIV Clinic in Rwanda. And this is a composite of work from Rwandan nurse investigators, student investigators, MPH students in Canada, and staff in Rwanda. I have no financial relationships to disclose. Okay, so the background. As you all know, gender-based violence is a major global public health problem, and the WHO in a 10-country study showed that the rates of domestic violence were between 15 and 71%, depending upon the country. Women reported both physical and sexual abuse by a husband or partner in that study. Many women also said that their first sexual experience was not consensual. The rates were between 1 out of 4 in Peru to 40% in South Africa. We've noticed that in post-conflict and developing countries, there are really very few resources dedicated to identifying or treating this very serious problem. In Rwanda, the ministries of health and gender are actually beginning to address this issue, and a recent survey showed that 25% of women in Rwanda had experienced domestic violence within the last 5 years, so they're putting actually energy into determining how to identify and address the problem. The HIV epidemic continues to be a major challenge, obviously, in global health. There are about 2.7 million new infections each year, and more than half of the current 33 million people living with HIV are women. HIV has been associated with gender-based violence in terms of both transmission and disease progression. So thinking about the two epidemics together of HIV and gender-based violence, the high prevalence of abuse and forced unprotected sex may obviously put women at increased risk of HIV transmission, especially in the context of poverty. And secondly, there's a bit of literature that shows that lifetime and incident trauma and its psychosocial consequences are associated with mortality as well as reduced adherence and poor treatment outcomes in women with HIV. This is a study we did in the US in a group called, the study's called WISE, a Women Interagency HIV Study, a national multi-site study, and we can see that lifetime violence among women with HIV was very high, about 67%, recent violence about 20%, and about almost 1 out of 3 women had experienced childhood sexual abuse, and child sexual abuse was associated with behaviors that were very high risk in terms of potentially getting HIV, in terms of drug use, male partners with HIV, and transactional sex, trading sex for drugs, money, or shelter. We also have learned that when women are in HIV programs, they are less likely to adhere to antiretroviral therapy. HART means highly active antiretroviral therapy. When indicated by their CD4 and viral load, they're more likely to not be taking medicines if they're currently using drugs, if they've had a history of physical or sexual abuse, and actually the racial disparities are apparent, with white women being much more likely to be on therapy. So the goals of this project were to determine the efficacy of screening for domestic violence among women attending an HIV clinic in Rwanda, to determine the prevalence of domestic violence in that group, and to provide a psychosocial intervention for women with domestic violence through group and individual counseling. So women's equity and access to care and treatment has been providing primary HIV care and psychosocial support to over 1,800 women in Kigali starting in 2004. And during 2009, trauma counselors randomly screened women who were entering the clinic for domestic violence that was unrelated, and any violence that was unrelated to the genocide. And if women reported violence during this screen, they were referred to a psychiatric nurse who's housed inside the clinic, you'll hear more about that, support groups, and or a legal counselor as needed. So the questions that we use for screening are similar to questions that are used in the States for screening. It was in Kinyarwanda. A lot of focus groups were had to actually determine the right words. So this is a translated to Kinyarwanda back translation off of a lot of different understandings of what violence, trauma, ill health, hurting would be in the Rwandan context. So basically the questions were, have you ever been beaten, sexually mistreated, or frightened by your partner or husband? Was it ever or in the past year? Do you think that your partner or husband spies on you and deprives you of your right to have relationships with others? And does what you feel make you feel unsafe at home, or does it affect or bother your family life? So the results. Trauma counselors screened 442 HIV-infected women at our clinic in Kigali. The median age was 31. One out of three were widows. 50% were currently married or in a relationship, and 10%, only 10% had completed more than sixth grade. The prevalence of abuse in the population that was screened was 62%, almost the exact same number that I showed you in our national study in the States. About 27%, or one out of four, actually said that they had experienced this violence within the last year. 41% reported physical abuse, one out of four reported sexual abuse, and the largest number, 59%, complained of emotional abuse. So these support groups were set up. They were conducted at a site away from the We Act clinic, but a site known to the patients who come to our program. And 62 women who were off, all the women who said that they had experienced domestic violence were invited to join support groups, which happened weekly at this other place. And 62 of the women who reported domestic violence joined the WEAC support groups, which were held weekly. A trained trauma counselor and a peer advocate facilitated the support groups. And over 80% of the women who were attending the support groups reported living with their abusive partner. There were several themes that came out during the support groups about the relationship between gender-based violence and being HIV. So I've tried to tease them out for you a little bit. One was poverty and land insecurity. So in general, when there was unequal power between the men and women, especially related to gaining finances for taking care of oneself, feeding, taking care of your children, that could be considered a sort of form of gender-based violence. When HIV was there on top of it, and women were women felt more ill and were not able to actually engage and negotiate with their partner, it was sort of exacerbated. HIV exacerbated this gender-based violence. Issues related to rights, related to property, children, especially among women who might be in a partner relationship but not a married relationship, were also exacerbated. Being HIV positive sometimes was an excuse used by partners to actually abandon the woman and her family and provide support for the children. One of the issues that was something that we actually had been hearing about for the past few years, but really got a better sense of during these support groups, was a concept of how men were preventing women from accessing HIV/AIDS prevention and care services. And this would happen that men didn't want the women to go to the clinic because it would out the family of having HIV. They wouldn't want them to attend support groups as well because it was an extra visit. But most stressful, I think, for the women was that the women reported that their husband or partner refused to go for their own HIV care but used the patient's supply of antiretroviral therapy, therefore not making it so that the woman herself did not have an adequate supply of medications for that time period. There was also a perceived lack of ability to negotiate sexual relationships, and this was in terms of forced sexual abuse when the woman felt ill or didn't want to engage in sex. It was related to when the woman said, I want you to use a condom to her partner, and he didn't want to. And when a woman actually felt that she could not afford taking care of herself or her children, and then felt she was forced to engage in transactional sex herself. So two cases that summaries. from women who are in the support groups. MM is 32 years old, married with 3 children. During the group, she said that her husband beat her because she asked him to use a condom. He also would not buy food for the family. She had significant anxiety and was referred to for weekly individual counseling. After some months, she felt stronger, began attending the weekly support groups. She shared her experience and problems with the group, and she heard testimonies from other women. She was also given a small amount of financial assistance from the program and started a small income generation program. Through her small income generation, she managed to help her family. Her husband actually was engaged and stopped the violence at home. She now serves as a support group facilitator and remains quite strong. The next woman was 47 years old. Her first husband had been killed in 1994 during the genocide. She was left with 3 children, and she really expressed feeling quite helpless and needing someone to support her and her children. She then married again. This man started beating her. She used to buy food herself for the family and tried to meet the other needs, but wasn't assisted by her husband. She came to the support group and sort of shared how she had been mistreated. She learned about her rights from both the legal and psychoeducational work that was done in the group, continued to come to the group, and went for individual counseling as well. She felt significantly stronger, and this is a model that we've seen. She brought her partner for counseling as well to talk about his problems, and the man continues with therapy, psychosocial therapy, and the couple seems to have a lot more accord right now. These men's groups were something that we really hadn't expected to happen. The patients asked WEAC staff, who were leading the support groups, to also speak to their partners. 29 male partners began attending a weekly men's support group facilitated by the WEAC trauma counselors. And there was a definitely decrease in patterns of abuse. And not all of these men were HIV infected. Some were representative of discordant couples, but a large number of the HIV infected men actually started coming to the clinic on their own and therefore no longer taking the patient's medications. The issue that was behind taking the patient's medications, as was articulated in both the men's group as well as the women's group, was issues of fear and stigma about being sort of outed in the community, of having HIV in the family. So the impact of the support groups, we felt that the psychoeducation really helped women better understand the cycle of violence and challenge cultural beliefs within Rwanda and many places, which find that male violence is tolerable. The women acquired negotiating skills that helped produce household peace and reduce abuse. Financial assistance definitely helped women feel independent and improve relationship with their partners. Many women reported increased strength within 6 months of the support group, and 12 women became facilitators themselves, sharing testimonies which really helped other women reduce abuse. Several patients' husbands stopped using patients' medications and began attending the HIV clinic on their own. So in conclusion, gender-based violence impacts the health and well-being of HIV-positive women and their families over the long term. And being HIV-positive can exacerbate the effects of gender-based violence. So our sort of narrow understanding of gender-based violence as important for transmission and then maybe the course of the illness, I think it has a much larger context in a woman's life when both of the epidemics actually impact a population and women individually. So culturally appropriate screening for domestic violence can be quite transformative in HIV clinic settings. And I didn't share with you that when we first were discussing the idea of using screening questions, many of you probably know that, like in any emergency room department, it's sort of standard to ask 2 or 3 questions related to domestic violence. And the usual way we ask it in the States is, you know, domestic violence is a very serious problem, and we want to, we ask these questions of everybody. We're not singling you out. Have you ever been beaten or sexually forced to have sex or hit or emotionally abused by your partner? Would you like us to refer you to someone else? Do you feel safe to go home? And we sort of do that, you know, right after taking vital signs. It's not like we sort of get to know the person. Well, in Rwanda, that was totally unacceptable. The staff said, no, you have to sort of have a 15-minute conversation with someone before you could sort of get to this topic. It meant that you can't screen a lot of people if you're having a half-hour conversation each time. after actually engaging in the process for a while, the staff was able to actually reduce that time quite significantly. I think it was both their comfort with it as well as the reality of so many women wanting to actually talk about it and answer the question. The women responded well to talking about domestic violence in support groups after being screened in a Rwandan HIV primary care clinic. And addressing domestic violence for women with HIV through support groups and counseling may reduce abuse within relationships. We liked the fact that after 6 months, some women who had experienced domestic violence could become peers or facilitators to help others in similar situations. And the added benefit of addressing abuse among couples with HIV to increase the number of male partners attending HIV clinics is sort of very interesting. In many developing countries, Africa, sub-Saharan Africa in particular, the numbers of people who are attending clinics are predominantly women and not men. So if dealing with gender-based violence was a way to also increase the number of men attending to clinic, it's just another reason to do the right thing. Thank you. So we have time for questions, if you have any. Bobby?
Bobby from New York. The experience with involving men in both counseling and in treatment, are you familiar with, one, do you think that would work for your cohort? Does that work for the people you work with in Chicago or LA or New York?
We've never actually done it in our clinic setting in Chicago or in the WISE, but that's more research observational. So we haven't tried that as an intervention, though NIH has just told us we're allowed to do intervention trials when we reapply, so it's something to absolutely think about. I sort of can never give a talk often on women with HIV without someone saying, so what are you doing for the men? Isn't that like really important, the connection? And you know, really in a lot of the work, my work in the US, we sort of didn't. And the fact that in Rwanda, the staff and the patients just made that really clear that you're not intervening effectively if you don't. Was just, you know, a lesson that means that we should probably absolutely think about that. I'm sure there are people who are doing good work related to partners and abuse in the States, but I don't have good experience in. Other? Yes. It wasn't sort of the context of what we were doing generally there, but I think it's a great idea and they're very committed to continuing it. And I absolutely was thinking that as we have like a lot of MPH students coming this summer, to think about actually understanding what it was that they actually experienced that was both prior and during the support group and since to make sort of these behavioral changes and to figure out if they can be used to do that for other men. I think it's a great idea. Gordy, it's like old home week here.
So obviously this form of abuse of taking the part of the white medicine, something that's sort of a very serious form of abuse, then has this been reported before in A and B? What does it mean in terms of assessing adherence? So here you have a woman taking 100% of her pills in terms of medication possession ratio, which is one way to measure this. But she's getting 50% of meds.
Right. I mean, actually, what had really happened was before we started this specific program related to violence, the women had actually in support groups shared with us that this was happening. You know, the staff might have understood it better than some of us, that it was really important. I couldn't quite get my hands around it, but the women's stories during the focus group, and then they're saying, like, you have to, you know, we can change this, let's do something about it, was very effective. So that now, our, you know, there are adherence questions that are standardly done every visit in the clinic, and they're inclusive now of this issue. We haven't yet reported this in the literature. Other comments? Yeah.
So if a woman happens to report that her partner is taking some of her medications, does your clinic allow for her to get the meds she's missing, or how does that work?
Yeah. I mean, you know, the issue is like, There's a whole procurement approach, which is monthly supplies that come from the governmental sponsored, which gets their resources from the Global Fund and from PEPFAR, and we are part of that public health system. So it gets complicated if you sort of, someone would need, if many people would need 2 months supply each month, but we've sort of, you know, ensured that the woman is able to get what she needs. But I think the women weren't really reporting it so much initially. They were reporting it, interestingly, which is why Mary's next talk will be so important, they weren't necessarily reporting it to their clinical providers, the nurses and doctors that were carrying them in the HIV clinic. They were reporting it in their support groups. And the concept of integrating mental health services in the most concrete sense with primary HIV care is something that we've thought a lot about, both here in the U.S. as well as in Rwanda, and I think this sort of points it out again. So, yeah. One more question? Okay, go ahead. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I didn't hear the last sentence, but you're basically asking what's the financial assistance program? What interventions? It was actually increasing negotiation strategies for the woman. It was understanding, the women would tell us that when they first were in this relationship with this man, and they would ask their sisters and their mothers, this guy's hurting me, you know, what do I do about it? And they were told by family members, well, that's sort of what happens. That's just the way it is. There's nothing you can do about this. But within the context of the support group and the context of understanding laws and engagements in Rwanda about attending to this prominent problem, the women sort of got a better sense that that wasn't just necessary, that this was to be the way it is. So actually feeling strong about being more assertive, involving our staff to also engage her partner, but all of those seem to be quite effective. I mean, I don't think it's only a certain percentage of the women who actually reported violence went to the group, so it was actually people already who were sort of motivated to deal with it. As people know who do domestic violence work, people don't immediately either attend to good care or referrals for reducing abuse or getting out of situations. It takes a lot of support and time. In this case, for those people, the negotiating skills and the understanding of that this wasn't necessary, that this wasn't part of her relationship with a partner, as well as feeling support from other women, I think were the major things. Mary might address it more. Okay? Okay.